All right, welcome to today's class. Normally on Monday we begin by reviewing how the quiz went, but we don't have a quiz to review. And I still don't actually have an ETA about when we might. I had said that we would release one this evening to be due on Friday. It is unclear if a quizzing site will come online before then. However, I thought, you know, we could probably talk about why we don't have a quizzing site, why the course website has been down the majority of the past 5 days, explain a little bit about what happened, because you know most of the things we'll need to explain this process. So we're going to start with that. We'll then dive into some issues about what this means for assignments and so forth, and then get to our main material. But let's start by explaining what happened. Okay, the CS department has a server with many, many disks. Many multi-terabyte disks are physically part of the server system that we have. And these many disks are each individually assigned, typically multiple internal virtual images, but effectively they're all sort of combined together into a file structure called ZFS. ZFS doesn't stand for anything. It was originally introduced just as a ZFS. Most file systems that end with FS, the FS stands for file system. This one never stood for anything. This is a nice file system. It has automatic backups and versioning and various things that make it very convenient. It has worked very well for us since we introduced this about 3 years ago, I guess now. I may have the timing off a little bit there. All well and good. So this is being used for all of your portal accounts. This is being used for our course website. This is being used for all a significant portion of our graduate and research that's going on, various faculty accounts and so forth. Not being used for our Kaito submission system because I didn't want students to be able to get on that file system, but it is being used for a lot of these other purposes. It's also being used amongst the other things we have in here is a DNS server information and DHCP, which we've talked about, right? DNS allows us to turn a computer name into an IP port, and DHCP allows a computer to gain an IP address when it connects to a network. Okay, so what happened was years ago, we had an employee working in our system staff that is no longer a member of our system staff. This had caused some lore loss, who had taken a disk sitting out there somewhere and had decided to access it instead of with ZFS with a protocol called iSCSI. SCSI is an older format for talking to external devices like disks, a protocol to use over the wire that connects your processor to your disk. And iSCSI is an internet-enabled version of it, so that you can use the internet protocol or something like thereunto to talk to disks, saving the need to have a physical connection to the disk in order to make it work. And on this disk had been some information about other disks, had been some information about DNS and DHCP as well. Said person that set this up had never, as far as we know, not mentioned this to other people, or if they did get lost, moved on to other work. And then our new person said, we have a disk. It doesn't seem to be used for anything. We could use some more disks in our ZFS. We are going to add this to the ZFS pool. Now we had a disk that was being talked to in the ZFS format and the iSCSI format. This means, in particular, if we think about what needs to go on disks, we certainly have data, right? We have our various code or whatever it is that goes in a file. But we also, as we've learned about with permissions, somewhere inside the disk, we need to store the name of the file, the permissions of the file, the directory it is sitting in, the modification time, and so forth. And so this information, called the content of the file, the data, and since this is data about the data, this is called the metadata. And every file system has a data structure for storing the metadata on the disk. Sometimes this is a tree, sometimes this is a table, there are various array, there's different versions of this out there. We now had a disk that was trying to write to that metadata format in two different ways, which meant they were overwriting one another's information, which meant when one of them went to read the information, it was finding data where it expected to find data, but the wrong data. And this caused one or the other of them to misinterpret what the purpose of the other drives were, causing this one mismatched drive to start creating incorrect updates to other drives, propagating throughout the system. And thus, our file system went down. Now, fortunately, ZFS has a system of logging things. It had backups theoretically included, but because a lot of the metadata had been corrupted, we couldn't just use that. So instead, what they did was they shut down the whole thing, patched up a little bit of the parts that would work, Bootstrap got a clean system, and then started copying over from the backup part of the disk, because each of these disks had old and new versions, started copying from the backup version of the disk into a new disk array, copying it over a bit at a time. So the iSCSI disinfected the other disks. Social disk dancing. Very nice. Very nice. Yes, we should have practiced social disk dancing. So we started copying information over using a protocol that, if you ever deal with large systems, it'll be worth learning. There's this tool called rsync, which is a recursive synchronization protocol to copy information over. And as we would copy everything we needed off of one of these disks, we could then clear it out and add it to this pool of now available disks. This took from about 2 p.m. on Thursday until about 8 p.m. at night on Saturday, just to perform the copy. Which could have solved everything theoretically, except we had lost this information because this disk didn't have that backup system. And that had some information that was necessary for a DNS and DHCP. So things like kaitos.cs.virginia.edu no longer worked. We got the DNS working again, but along the way, the Kaitos server that had been sitting here, over here, Kaitos, which had its own file system, and initially was running just fine, first lost the ability to be seen by outside servers, and then lost the ability to connect to them because it was denied an IP address. So last I checked, it is still sitting there, it is still running just fine, it still is not connected to anything, it is on a queue for our system staff to resolve. Also, in the process of our syncing it back over, this ended up reorganizing the data and not everything was copied over perfectly. So the ZFS system that makes backups has some intelligence in how it makes it backs up, tries to avoid making backups of some temporary information, some cache files and so forth. Amongst the information that was not backed up, as far as I can tell so far, or perhaps was just too slow and so they skipped in the first rsync, was all of the recorded lectures for this class. Huzzah! So I had some still sitting on a hard drive and put them all on Colab. And once I'm confident the system is stable, we'll copy them back over to the system. That only is really since we started going online. My previous system, I don't have backups from before spring break. Sorry. Also, this means that as far as I know, I had 4 years of lectures recordings on the system, and as far as I know, they're just all gone. So normally I'd say, we can show you what COA2 was like last year, except ta-da, we can't. Anyway, I believe that will be resolved. I believe the data actually does exist, but pulling it off is going to be a lower priority thing. Likely won't happen this semester, to be honest. Sorry. So all of this is going on. Along the way, they realize they're missing some stuff. So I don't know if any of you happened to try, but there was a period of time on Sunday and this morning where you could SSH into portal, but module load wouldn't work, so you couldn't run a compiler. There was a period of time when the website was up, and then it was down again because we realized we forgot something, and so we took down the file system to copy over something important and brought it back up. Anyway, this has all been going on. This has created a significant amount of headache for many people. And on the whole, given that there was human error that started this all off of not noticing that iSCSI was talking to something, beyond that, that I think our system staff has actually done an excellent job at helping bring things up in an appropriate way, but are not done yet. As of about an hour and a half ago, they declared Portal functional and were willing to begin looking at other systems. And so Kaitos is on that list. In theory, at some point, it will come back up. Once it come back up, in theory, all of the data it had when it stopped being connected will still be there, but that won't include the quiz because I hadn't uploaded the quiz that was going to happen just yet. And how quickly I will know about this and be able to put that in there, I don't know. I also, Kaitos is being used also for theory of computation, discrete mathematics, introduction to programming and operating systems in addition to our course. And so they may take more priority over getting co-working for me if they need some work. I am the chief admin for Kaitos, although we have multiple admins on it. Is there a chance all your grades got wiped? There is not. So Kaitos is designed every morning at 4 a.m. to copy all of its data onto multiple other servers. And so I have all of the information that was available at 4 a.m. on Thursday the 16th. Because it lost internet connectivity before 4 a.m. on Friday the 17th, I don't have the 17th data. So if you submitted something Thursday morning, I probably have it on the Kaitos hard drive. I can't tell because I can't talk to Kaitos because it's not currently available with DHCP and is in a locked room downstairs. But I know that I won't have lost any of your past work. I have verified those archives are all working correctly, so all of that information is there. There is a reasonable chance, though, that when Kaitos comes back up, I might end up prioritizing, say, the 600-student CS1110 course over our course in getting things up and running if there needs to be some getting up and running work to be done. I hope there won't be. I think we can just plug ahead and everything will work. But expect some delays in all of that, and I will let you know when I believe everything is working all correctly. Sorry. So, this happened. Any thoughts, comments, questions about what happened before we dive into, we will dive into, but before we dive into what this means for deadlines and grades and so forth. Okay, so all of that happened. Let's talk a little bit about logistics and what this means. As of an hour and 2 hours ago, something like that, our course website was up. I'm afraid to press the refresh button in case it went down while I was talking to you. I don't think we're completely stable on this yet. I think it'll be a few hours before they are sure that the web server system is working properly. So in theory, everything's available there. However, I have loaded I've loaded the most important information into the CoLab resources. I'm generally not a fan of CoLab. I believe in being open and sharing everything, and CoLab is closed and doesn't. But it's a separate server. The chance it will crash the same time as the other is low. So there is a lectures folder that, if you look inside this, you will see it has the audio and video of the things I have done via Zoom and all of the files from all the other lectures, I believe. I believe I did all the way back to the semester. I may be missing some. These are the ones I had available. Also in the resources folder, I have made a copy of the Life Skeleton tar ball, which may have been lost on the server as part of what happened. I have a copy, here it is. As well as I made a PDF of the Life requirements because CoLab doesn't handle nicely the HTML files I usually use. Those are there. So the information you would need to continue making progress on PA07, as well as to review at least the last few weeks of lecture, are all here on CoLab, if all else fails. The deadline I am expecting for that, my hope is to have 3 days-ish that you can use the server and see if it thinks your life is working. I really need to rename this assignment. I keep saying things that have meanings I don't intend. I don't really care. I do care if your life is working, but that isn't what I'm talking about. I'm talking about if your solution to Conway's game of life is working. So I'm hopeful that Kaitos sometime, probably sometime tomorrow, will be in a state that we can say, yes, it's working. And so then you'll have 3 days to have that submitted Friday. So I've tentatively put the due date of life on Friday instead of on Tuesday. That might change. I also have spent so many hours trying to deal with issues associated with this, I have done very little work to develop our lab. So it may be very light. We'll see how that goes. So those things are there. I do still have on the schedule a listed assignment for the 28th, largely because this test is something we haven't otherwise talked about, and because it had really high grades. And I thought you might like that. We'll see. I mean, this was designed as an interactive thing on Kaitos. I believe I can make this interactive thing on a different server if I need to. Although if life gets pushed that far back, we might not do it. Most people that did it in an hour or two, sat down and just did it. So I'm not too worried about the reduced time there. Whether we will have quiz 8 at all, I don't know. There's a reasonable chance if I can't get that out today or early tomorrow, I might just bump it into quiz 9 instead. And just merge those two. So, I think that is all of that kind of information I wanted to say. Thoughts, comments, questions, anything else I should clarify about this unexpected interruption in our already interrupted semester? Okay. One other thing to note because of emails Provost has sent you. So the Provost has decreed that A through C, if you want to, you can either get your A plus, I guess, through C grades. You can either get them as letters or you can get them as ACR. And they've decreed that C minus through D minus can be turned into a GR, and that F can be turned into an NC. This bit right here was a little bit of awkward for CS, because we have traditionally said that if a course is a prerequisite, you needed a C minus in it to move forward. And so what we are going to do in this class, I haven't had a chance to update things yet, but I'm just going to throw away C minus. If you were going to earn a C minus, you'll earn a C instead. I just won't give any C minus grades so that we don't have to worry about the differences between these. So then if you do this, it will serve as a prereq or anything else that require that a C or better would have gotten you. This will serve as credit. So if you need to take the class, but it's not a prereq for anything, this will be fine. It will check the box. And then NC won't give you credit. These will contribute to your GPA. These will not. Have no impact, not numerator or denominator. I've had various questions about which one should I pick? I don't know the answer to that question. For a while, I was just saying there's no downside to doing this. As a matter of fact, this right-hand side is what I wish we could always do. And I thought that was true for a while until I heard that the first one I heard of was that Harvard Med School decided that if you opted for a credit, no credit grade when a letter grade was available, that this would penalize you somehow in Harvard Med School application. So far as I know, no other graduate school or graduate program has announced a similar decision, but I can't promise that nobody will. I believe if you're going to industry and have a reasonable GPA, you have no downside to going the credit, no credit route. If you're thinking of going to graduate school, there might be some independent reason to go for a GPA, even if it drops your GPA side. And certainly if you think this semester you're getting a higher GPA than your current average, then there's no downside to boosting it by taking letter grades in your classes. I would, in general, discourage mixing and matching. Some courses get letters and some don't. I can readily imagine that causing confusion and questions about anybody who looks at your transcript. And so if you're confident people will look at your overall GPA but not your transcript, then picking your classes that you'll get an A in, you think, is a good idea, probably. But if you think anybody's going to look at your transcript and there's some semester which has the annotation, the provost has promised the default grading system was credit, no credit, and they see a bunch of CRs and then a few A's, they're going to say, wait, why are these A's? And so that could cause a difficulty. Do employers look at transcripts during recruiting? Not usually. Although they also don't usually verify your GPA. So early stages of recruiting, typically your resume is all they see. Some employers will ask you to send them an official transcript or an unofficial transcript as part of what's going on, usually later in the process. My general sense, though, is that from talking to our industry advisory board, for example, they aren't very interested in your GPA, and they don't care about your transcript much at all, except we do have several of our employers employ a lot of our students. They've specifically said they're going to find out your grade in specific classes they care about. So the 12 companies represented on CS's Industrial Advisory Board, 4 of them have told me explicitly that they will find out how you did in and had a list of courses they cared about for what they're doing, which means they will be looking at your transcript. That's typically only the companies that know UVA well or that are operating in some sort of specialized space. So I guess it's somewhat of a gamble. Your initial pass, I would not expect them to see your transcript. I expect several of them will look at it later on. Can I say what companies? I don't believe the fact they did this was given to me with the permission to share it with others. Sorry. I have found that it works well to maintain good relationships with people by not sharing things they didn't give you permission to share. And I think that may have been the details of their recruiting process that I have learned through these things. I expect if I spoke to individual companies, I would have some difficulties there. How does this work for the pilot? We did not take the typical courses. So basically should just work. If you're a BSCS student, so for COA 2 in particular, BSCS students will need to take operating systems afterwards, and COA 2 is a prereq for operating systems. So if you're a BSCS student, to move forward, you'll need to get at least a C. There are going to be no C minuses, but a C minus or better, a credit score. If you're a BA student, COA 2 is potentially a terminal course. As I say, you don't need to take any other courses to have as a prereq, so a GR will be fine. When you look at your other classes, DSA 2 is not required for any required course that follows, nor is SD. So this semester, if you're a BA student, getting all GRs will still let you graduate. If you're a BSCS student, a CR in COA 2 and a GR in the other two will still allow you to graduate. I should comment that although not DSA 2 and SD aren't required for any required courses, they are required for some electives. And so again, I would still shoot, of course, for getting a higher grade. Well, getting a D minus in DSA 2 will affect you because it'll impact your GPA. But getting a GR in DSA 2 won't prevent your further taking courses that don't depend on DSA 2. So if you're thinking you want to go into AI or where else will this be a prereq for? I believe we're thinking DSA 2. I'm going to get this wrong because DSA is not my specialty. But I believe that we said that AI and parallel computing, and I remember there was one other. Anyway, so this is my understanding. I should comment, I don't make this decision officially. Officially, the person that handles how the pilot courses are prereqs for other courses is Mark Sheriff. And so if he decides to say something different than what I said, he wins. But my understanding is we're mostly using DSA 2 in the position that CS 4102 currently is for prerequisites. Anything else before we dive into our actual material about grades, about picking between these things? Just, I guess, as a reminder, my understanding is that this Friday, I think, you will automatically all switch over to the right-hand system, and then you will have until midnight, Monday or Tuesday, I don't remember which, to optionally switch back to the other. So I expect most of you will find that going with the CRGRNC is the right choice to do, releases stress from you, doesn't impede your future plans. I think if you're planning to go to grad school, it's probably wiser to go the letter grade route. And otherwise, you can play the game of, will this semester boost or drop my GPA? Would be sort of the things I would use to think about it if I were you. With the caveat that I can't predict the future. I don't know if other schools will decide to follow Harvard Med's example and do strange things. Okay. Then let's see if we can explode your brains with complicated weirdness. All right. When we are designing the COA classes, we'll look, if we think back about 2 years ago, a meeting with a committee of our faculty that sort of dealt with COA-related topics, and we were talking about what we should do, what should be included, what shouldn't, what was important enough to put in the courses, what was in our current courses but probably could be left aside, and what we wanted these courses to be. And in that conversation, somebody made a comment that sort of ended up being the touchstone, the thing that we would use to pick whether certain topics were in or out. And the touchstone they used was they should be able to understand exploits like Meltdown. And so considerable portions of this class were sort of, this certainly wasn't the only goal, but this turned out to be a simple statement that could cut the line between important and not important for lots of parts of the class. So let me just try to give a little context here. We're going to spend some time talking about Meltdown and associated attack Spectre today and tomorrow and Wednesday. That's going to be our topics. If we need to, we'll run into Friday, though I really hope to use Friday to just talk about anything you want to talk about. But anyway, this was one of several attacks that's come out in the past decade. This one came out just 3 years ago or less, that depends on a strange aspects of modern hardware, a software-based security exploit based on hardware. And so we're going to dive through how Meltdown works. Along the way, we're going to touch a significant subset, if not everything, we've talked about all semester long. This single attack is going to tie a lot of it together. So I'm going to start with just a small amount of code. I'm going to write some we're going to end up with, I believe, we'll only need 4 assembly instructions. We'll add a fifth one to make it slightly more effective. But we're going to write 4 assembly instructions. Ordinary assembly instructions you have seen before, all but one of them assembly instructions that you will understand readily along the way. And they are going to end up having a strangely exploitative power. I should have pre-written this, sorry. Where do I want to go next? No, we'll skip that. We'll do this one. Okay, here is my code. This is the core of Meltdown. This code is going to allow us to read the memory contents of any process, not just our process, any process, all of the processes running in the computer and regular user program is going to be able to read the contents using this code. So let's walk through what this code is doing, and then we'll explore why this is going to do this remarkable I can read all memory behavior. So we're starting by zeroing out RAX. Why are we zeroing out RAX? This turns out to be so that mostly because we're going to try to read a single byte on the next line, and we want only the byte. Remember, RAX is a 64-bit register. AL is the low order 8 bytes of it. So we're zeroing out all of those high order bits, and then we're copying over 1 byte of memory. So we're reading 1 byte is what these first two instructions are doing. And we're going to cause this to let us read memory that isn't our own by picking RCX correctly and doing a little bit of extra setup. Okay? So I read 1 byte of memory, and then the next thing I do is I shift it to the left by 12. Okay? Now, when we think about shifting to the left by 12, hopefully, after your experiences with PAs 2 and 3, the idea of things with 12 might just maybe tickle a little bell here. This is a page offset. What we're doing, we've read a single byte into A. So A is a number between 0 and 255. And we're going to use A as part of an address later on. But we're going to spread it out. We're going to multiply that by 4096 so that every possible byte we read will be the address of a different page of memory. We're going to finish making it the address of a page by giving it an offset here. We're going to add two numbers together. So this is going to sort of make it a page instead of a single byte. We're going to use the thing we read from memory as memory. And then we're going to add it to an offset to a base. We're going to use it effectively as the index into an array. Because it only goes from 0 to 255, we're going to need to have RBX is going to point to an array of, and we need 2 to the 8th times 2 to the 12th bytes. So we just need 2 to the 20th bytes. We have a 1 megabyte array, which completely, a small enough size we can easily do. We make an array, and we read from this array into a register. Now, what we get out of this would be the contents of this array. And this array is going to be our array, not somebody else's array. We've got 2 memory reads, okay? So if we think about what's going on, let's try to draw a picture and show what's going on. Let's talk about our contents of all memory. We're going to have somewhere here in memory, probably on the heap, we're going to have RBX pointing to this 1 megabyte array. That's going to be code we ran, our own code. But what we want to do is be able to read other people's code. And so what we're going to try to do is we want to read something from up here in kernel memory. So we're going to use an RCX that's up here in kernel address space. Now, traditionally, it actually has changed as a consequence of Meltdown just in the past year and a half, but traditionally, part of the kernel address space would contain a direct one-to-one mapping between virtual and physical addresses with a slight offset. And so somewhere in here, you'd be able to find all the physical addresses and can read them all. Even if you can't do that, you could at least be able to read what's in the kernel's memory. Anything it's storing about other processes, anything it needs to know, you should be able to find it up there. And so what we're going to do is we're going to point RCX to kernel memory. Now, if we think up and then we're going to use what we read there, a byte of what we read, as an index into this array. Why would we use it as an index into an array? So this is going to be our exploit address. And the concept we're going to do here is, well, okay, we learned what happens if you access an address that's on a page where it has a protection violation. This will cause a seg fault. It's going to cause a page fault first, which is then going to call an operating system handler, is going to check the address we are trying to use, realize we didn't have rights to use it, and create a protection signal and send it down to the user saying you're not allowed to do that. So we would not expect to ever reach the next line because this line is going to have an exception. In particular, it's going to have a page fault, a fault caused by the page table. Except, we also have out of order. Hey, so we talked last time and several classes leading up to this, we've talked about these ideas of out of order processors. What happens is as these instructions are coming along, they come down to the end of the issue stage after going through other steps, and they get sent out to different functional units to go do their work. And because a memory access needs to go to memory, it also needs to check the page table entry to compare writes and so forth. It is common to have multiple micro-ops, multiple mu-ops for a single move. A mu-op to serve check to see if it's in the cache, a mu-op to go talk to RAM if it isn't, perhaps. Maybe those will be combined. A mu-op to check the protection rights versus what the program is allowed to do and see if we're allowed to do things. But eventually, that's all going to get back to our reorder buffer. Okay? And so eventually, somewhere here in our reorder buffer, if we think of instructions moving the serve this way, we have our XOR, and we have our move, and we have our shift, and we have our move. Okay? And they're all initially unfinished, and they may finish in any arbitrary order. Okay? Although, because of data dependencies, you'd expect them to resolve in order because A goes to A goes to A goes to A. The A register is used in all of them, and only the last one is used only as a source. So I would expect to see some dependency between these instructions. Although I guess that's a write to read, so I don't really have a dependency between the first two. But anyway, these will finish in some order. And so eventually this one will finish after that one has finished and before the others have finished. And what will be put here is there is an exception we need to handle. Okay? Because things are happening out of order, we don't fire the exception right away. We fire the exception as they leave the reorder buffer. So we know the exception happens after some things have occurred and before others have. And nothing in these later instructions will have committed. The memory accesses and so on will not have modified RDX. We won't have done anything to RDX. None of that information will become visible because this one here is going to have a fault. Except, along the way, as we're doing this in our out-of-order process, there is a chance, not a guarantee, but a chance that we'll get through things in such an order that there was something up here before that needed to wait, something that took a long time to resolve. And so we got the data and forwarded it down and performed this move down here before the first one was ready to go. And then once finally that's ready to go, then we retire to and throw out the rest. If that happens, then this will have touched the cache. We're reading from memory. Reading from memory impacts the cache. The reading from memory didn't have to wait for the reorder buffer because a reading from memory doesn't have any visible side effects. It has no effect on the state of the process. But it remains visible afterwards. So even though this one runs and this one runs and that one gets discarded and that one gets discarded, before this one got discarded, we're hoping that it sent some information out to memory and caused a line of memory to be cached. So we run this code. It will cause an exception. we'll handle the exception in some way. We'll create a signal handler to deal with the seg fault and return us back to our program to keep running. We know there will be an exception. We are ready for it. We know how to handle that. But once we get back from our exception, then what we're going to do is we're going to go look at this big array we had. And we're just going to read the first byte of every page and time how long it took. Okay, and so as we go along, reading that and sort of measuring the time, so we can think about all of our addresses from address 0 to address 255, and we can measure how many cycles each one takes to read using our high-resolution timers that we've been using to time things, right? Okay, and so we're going to find that in general, we're going to have a whole bunch of cache misses, which means we're going to take a lot of cycles. Because these are far apart, a whole page apart, I don't have any doubt. I have no worry about them being on the same cache line. Because pages are discontiguous in physical memory, I'm never going to have my cache cross line boundaries as part of what it's doing. So I'm going to have a lot of these sort of slow accesses. But one of them is going to be much faster because one of them will have been cached. And so I can run down the memory, I can measure which one was the fast one. And the one that was the fast one corresponds to the value I read into RAX. The value I read into RAX was the value I read out of memory that I wasn't supposed to be able to read. So by running this program, it will cause an exception. But before it causes an exception, it will modify cache. It will modify cache based on the contents of memory where I wasn't allowed to read memory. And then afterwards, I can time how long it takes to read everything in cache, see which one was fast, and whichever one was fast, I can say, ha, I now know what's in memory. It doesn't always work. I'm not guaranteed that my out of order cycle will have gotten to the second move before the first move is removed from the reorder buffer. So sometimes they'll all look slow. But if they all look slow, I can just do it again. So I can run this same code with the same RCX multiple times. In between each time, I will do some extra memory accesses to make sure nothing is in my cache. Clear out my cache of all of this array. Then I run this code, I time everything, I refill the cache with stuff that isn't in the array, and then I do it again. I do that over and over again until I find the fast one. Once I find the fast one, I now know that one byte of memory, that one byte of kernel memory in the kernel address space, space I wasn't allowed to access. When all of the cache accesses have the same index because you're multiplying by 2 to the 12th, i.e. conflict misses. Right, so that's a good question. And this selection of 2 to the 12th was carefully done based on understanding of the particular caches in question. So the paper on Meltdown, you can read, they do talk about how they picked that exact number. But if we had found there was something like that, we could have said, right, so currently we're saying sort of A shifted 12. And if we realized, oh dear, that keeps putting us on the same page, we could have done something like this, maybe, something like this, to make sure that we are hitting a different set index each time. For the particular caches that they found were common in processors that they were using, they actually found that 12 worked very well all by itself. But it is a good insight, right? We want to ensure that after we read a few of these addresses, the rest of them, if they were cached, will still be cached, that we haven't caused a conflict eviction along the way. Other questions? Sorry, let me also comment about why this works. I'll get to the virtual address space here in a moment. Okay, so, if we think about our caching, they're actually looking here only at the L3 cache in the paper, because the L1 cache is per core. The L2 cache tends to be per processor. So the L3 cache is the one that's shared by everybody, also has the biggest difference in timing. And so what they want is they want it to have, right, we have our set index, we have our block offset, and our tag. And the L3 cache high enough level cache. It's got pretty big blocks, but these blocks are never going to be a full page. There's also a big cache that's going to have a lot of set indexes, okay? And so the idea here is we're going to have, our pages are going to be way bigger than this, right? Our page offset will cover part of, but not all of the set index. And this turns out to be the case for the L3 caches in a lot of modern processors. But if they had wanted to, they could have had some little shift in here, and the number they would pick here would be enough to cause it to slide to different set indexes. Okay. Why does the user virtual address space have any mapping to kernel memory at all? A great question. Why is there anything up there? The answer has to do with how we handle exceptions. Okay? When an exception occurs in code, there needs to be an exception handler. And all addresses, chips are designed so all addresses are virtual addresses. So I need to have, at a minimum, I need to have the exception table, and I need to have the exception handling code in the virtual address space, so that as I have an exception occur, remember when an exception occurs, we switch from user mode to kernel mode, we look in the exception table to see what address we should go to, and then we jump to that address. And so all of those steps have to be able to work. And I have to have enough code here that if I need to load other things into the address space, I can. So we have to have something in the kernel virtual address space available. And so the tradition, it's actually changed typically as part of the solution to this problem, but the tradition up till about 2 to 3 years ago was we'll just put all of kernel address, we'll just never change it. Every page table in the entire program, all of the first half of that first level page table was just the same for every process. It all pointed out to the kernel code. And when we were switching process, we'd only have to switch the second half of that first level page table along with the ones after it, right? So all of our PTBRs pointed to pages that had that same first half mapped. As part of the way of recovering, of fixing this problem, it has become common to unmap most of kernel memory before switching to the user. So the user mode has only a smaller portion. Okay, so this, but we have to have something there, so there's got to be something we can read. This exploit was so dramatic because we typically had all of kernel address space done, and typically somewhere in kernel address space, they had all of physical pages. How does the virt kernel set physical memory? The traditional way most chips have is there's a protected instruction that you can tell the processor that this virtual address space is a direct map to the physical address space. So when we want to write a page table, we just access it with a physical address that we have told the processor maps to that particular thing. And so if you've hit the right addresses, and you could often find the right addresses by looking at the source code or inspecting how things worked in your process, once you figured out where your operating system was storing physical memory, you go read all of physical memory. And you know whose physical memory it was, because also somewhere in this physical page information was the list of processes. So I could find the process listing, go see what it thought its page table base register was pointing to, go there, read the bytes of the base register, and eventually read all of the contents of all memory of all processes using this process. A somewhat slow process involving creating a fault and handling it for every byte, and a probabilistic process, so we had to do it multiple times and read through memory. We were getting only a few hundred kilobytes per second rather than the gigabytes per second we might expect for direct memory access. But that was still fast enough that we could do this, and it's just a user process. It is not doing anything that to any part of the system looks wrong. There is nothing to audit about it. It's just running around, accessing memory that fails, creating a lot of protection violations, but maybe it's just doing that because it has bad handling of addresses. And so this was how the Meltdown attack worked. All right, why do we only need to read one byte at a time? Why not move Q%RCX to get 8 bytes at a time? It's a great question. Why am I only reading one byte? The answer to reading one byte has to do with what I'm doing with it next. I'm using it as an index into an array because I need to measure the caching of the array. I need to know how long it took to access all of the values I could get. So I have a loop that's looping over this. So if I used even 2 bytes instead, this is a loop that checks 255 times 256 memory accesses. If I had 2 bytes, I have to time 16,000 memory accesses. If I had 4 bytes, I have to time 2 billion accesses. So actually, the more information I read, the slower this is. If I could read a single bit, if there was a 1 bit to move, that would actually make this potentially even faster. There's some trade-off between the time of handling the exception and the time of checking my caching. And so it might be that 4 bits or something would be better, but 1 byte is practical. We can do it. We can read data. So this is the idea of the Meltdown exploit. Uses virtual memory, uses caches, uses signals, uses interrupts, uses exceptions, uses out-of-order execution. Almost everything of the whole semester is involved in just this one exploit. When we come back on Wednesday, we'll talk about the Spectre exploit and how this also applies in other kinds of contexts. We'll poke just a little bit at Java and sort of see how understanding these hardware underlying things shows up even in higher level languages as well. So I will talk to you all on Wednesday.